Well, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us once again. Today is May 11th, 2011, and we are doing a conference call of Ethics Refresher 2011, Part 2, the second of 6 hours. And we're going to be going through the rules of professional conduct as adopted in Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin. Everybody on the line today is from Wisconsin, so we'll probably steer a little bit more toward the Wisconsin rules. But the rules in all three states are generally identical. They're all adopted from the ABA model rules. While there are a few differences we'll highlight, in general, the rules are pretty much the same as they are in about 45 other states that have adopted some version of the ABA model rules of professional conduct. Last week we covered up through rule 1.6, and today we're going to start in with rule 1.7, which talks about conflicts of interest. We're doing a live conference call today. I'm coming to you from St. Paul, Minnesota. In addition, we are recording today's program for the podcast. Podcast listeners, I will give a couple of code words during the program, and then to get your certificate of attendance, you will need to send those code words to me to verify your attendance. But anyway, jumping right in to Rule 1.7, the next couple of rules are going to talk about conflicts of interest. 1.7 simply states the general rule regarding conflicts of interest. And Rule 1.8 will go on to some specific situations. But the general rule is conflicts of interest are bad, and you don't want to engage in conflicts. The general definition is found in Rule 1.7, and that is that you may not represent a client if that representation is directly adverse to another client. You probably didn't need to go to law school to figure that out. You can't represent both the plaintiff and the defendant in the same case. So that's a pretty easy situation. Or you cannot represent a client if there is a significant risk that the representation of one or more of your other clients will be materially limited. So again, that's the general definition. The next rule covers some specific situations. But in general, the rule is that if there's a significant risk that your representation to another client will be materially limited, that prevents you from taking on the new client. Now, conflicts of interest can be waived if the client gives informed consent. There are some situations where it can be waived. It cannot be waived if the case involves the assertion of a claim by one client against another client in the same litigation. That would be a pretty blatant example of representing both the plaintiff and the defendant, and in that case, the clients would not be able to waive it, no matter how informed their consent was. That can lead to many gray areas. The next rule, 1.8, covers some specific situations that come up from time to time. But because this is one of those rules that's not particularly black and white, the ABA comments regarding this section give into a number of additional specific situations that might arise. So look those over, but in general, conflicts of interest should be avoided if it materially limits your ability to represent another client. Well, Rule 1.8 goes into a number of specific rules on conflicts of interest, not necessarily issues that come up every day, but some of them are issues that needed to be resolved at one point, so they are written into the rules. And it begins by talking about entering into a transaction with a client where you acquire an interest in the client's property, for example, a security interest. A mortgage on the client's property or a lien on an automobile or something like that. The general rule is that you may not enter into that. So There are exceptions when you can, but again, the general rule is that you can't do it, period, unless one of these exceptions applies. For those exceptions to apply, for you to acquire a proprietary interest in your client's property, first of all, the transaction has to be fair and reasonable. You need to give written notice to the client that he or she should obtain outside advice, and the client has to give written consent. So there might be some rare situations where you might want to do that, and if so, then you would have to make sure those exceptions to the rule are all covered. The next situation that comes up from time to time is gifts from a client. And this includes, and probably mostly includes, of wills from a client. Your client wants to give you a gift. So your millionaire client comes in to have his will written, and he wants to give his entire estate to his trusted attorney. This rule covers that situation. Now, the rules in all of our three states vary somewhat on this, and we will cover, probably steer mostly toward Wisconsin, but we'll cover the rules in the other states. In general, the prohibition is that the attorney should not draft the instrument unless one of these exceptions is met. So if your client wants to write a will giving you his entire estate, it's probably a good idea for you to not write that will. But there are some exceptions where that would be proper. And the gifts in this case apply not only to a gift to the lawyer, but it could also be to for a gift to the lawyer's parent, child, sibling, or spouse. Those are the terms used in Minnesota, and the other ones we will see are pretty similar. There is an exception, however, if the client, that is the person giving the gift, is related to the person receiving the gift. In other words, the client is related to the lawyer or the lawyer's parent, child, sibling, or spouse. If that's the case, then this exception might apply. The rule in Iowa is similar, but uses a little bit different language. First of all, Iowa specifically says that a lawyer may not solicit a substantial gift. So you can't suggest the idea to your client that he give you the $1 million from his estate. And as in Minnesota, the rule states that the lawyer may not prepare an instrument giving the gift to the lawyer or a person related to the lawyer. And here they aren't quite specific on who that relative would be. So if it's a gift to your cousin, this rule might apply in Iowa, whereas it would not in Minnesota. But again, as in Minnesota, there's an exception if the recipient, that is you or your relative, is related to the client, the person giving the gift. Okay, they do define the relatives as being spouse, child, sibling, grandchild, parent, grandparent, or other relative with a close relationship. So if it's your third cousin who's receiving the gift and you don't have a close relationship with your third cousin, that's okay. But if it's your first cousin who you have a close relationship with who would be receiving the gift, then you should not be drafting the will in that case either. So those are the rules in Minnesota and Iowa. Now, Wisconsin gets a lot more specific, and the reason why, it appears, is that instead of just using the language of the ABA model rules, Wisconsin appears to have taken the substantive law of its law of trust and estates and incorporated that into the disciplinary rules. Now, even lawyers in other states should keep these rules in mind, because essentially what Wisconsin has done is taken the rules saying that the substantive rules of whether or not that gift will be valid. So again, the The disciplinary rules are just talking about, will the lawyer get suspended or disbarred for drafting this will? But what Wisconsin does is say is that you will get suspended or disbarred for drafting the will in cases when the will would not be effective anyway. So in other words, if in Minnesota or Iowa, if you are able to draft a will and you were able to sneak it in under one of these exceptions so that you do not get into disciplinary problems for drafting the will, well, that won't do you a lot of good if the will is no good in the first place. So what Wisconsin does is just take the rules of whether or not that gift is going to be valid and also incorporate those into the disciplinary rules. And for that reason, the rules in Wisconsin get a lot more specific. Well, in Wisconsin, like in the other state, or like in Iowa, the lawyer may not solicit any substantial gift from a client. So you can't say, please give me a gift of $1 million. If you say, please give me a box of chocolates for Christmas, that's probably okay, because that's probably not a substantial gift. And once again, you may not prepare an instrument such as a will giving a gift to you, the lawyer, unless all of the following requirements are met. First of all, the client must be a relative. So in other words, you are drafting a will for your mother or your father or your brother or something, and you must be the natural object of the bounty of the client. Now, that's a term of art from the law of trusts and estates, and it essentially means, are you the kind of person that that would normally get a gift in a will from this person? So if you're drafting a will for your second cousin and you get his entire estate and the rest of his family is cut off, well, that's not the kind of thing that people naturally do. You're not the natural object of that bounty. So that test would probably not be met there. On the other hand, if you are drafting a will for a parent and you, for example, are an only child and you get the entire estate, that seems natural. You are the natural object of that bounty, so that would probably be okay under this portion of the rule. On the other hand, if you are one of five children and your four brothers and sisters do not get anything, but you get everything, well, you're probably not the natural object. That's probably not a natural thing that happens. Now, there might be reasons for it. You're a struggling lawyer, and the parent thinks you need it. Your other siblings are well off, but even though that might be proper if some other lawyer drafted the will, you are probably not a natural object of that much bounty. So you might get into problems here, again, not just under the disciplinary rules, but whether or not the will be effective in the first place. Number two, all three of these tests have to be met for it to be proper. There is no reasonable ground to believe that the will be contested. So even if you think it will be contested on some ground other than you being the one who drafted it, you should not be drafting the instrument. And there can't be any risk that the public will lose confidence in the integrity of the bar. Finally, the amount of the gift must be reasonable and natural. So again, it's probably best just to avoid the situation entirely, because all of these rules are kind of subject to interpretation, both of whether you will get into trouble as an attorney for drafting it, and number two, whether the will actually serve its purpose. But there is an exception for in some situations it probably is proper. If it's a parent and you're getting a normal share of the estate. But even in those cases, it would probably be better to err on the side of caution and send your relative to another lawyer to actually draft the instrument. Another specific situation that's covered by this rule. Again, these are covering the specific kind of gray areas and putting a black and white rule. And that's the question of literary rights. Now, I have never been offered literary rights from my client, I don't think very many of my clients have had very literary cases. But if the crime of the century walks into your office and he doesn't have any money to pay you, but you know his book and movie rights are going to be worth a fortune when the case is over, you may not accept those literary rights until the case is concluded. And the reason why that's a conflict of interest is because it might be in your client's best interest to have the case proceed in a very boring fashion. And if you have literary rights, then you have an incentive to make the case as exciting as possible, and that might not be in your client's best interest. So therefore, until the case is concluded, you may not receive the literary rights. Now, when the case is over and you send your client a bill for $1 million and he says he doesn't have $1 million to pay you, at that point, once the case is over, it would be acceptable for you to take those literary rights in exchange for paying your bill, because at that point the risk is gone. The case is concluded now, so you can't do anything in the course of the case to make the story more interesting, possibly to the detriment of your client. So once the case is over, you can receive literary rights. But again, not an issue that probably comes up too often in the day-to-day practice, but it is codified in the rules. The next situation that is addressed by this rule is that you as an attorney may not provide financial assistance to your client, other than you may advance certain costs of the litigation and certain expenses, but those are itemized in the rule or discussed in the rule. But in general, if your client is, no matter how hard luck his case is, he says, I need to pay the rent, I need to buy groceries, and can you just advance this money to me and I'll pay you back when we settle the $1 million case. Well, no, you're not allowed to do that. So rather than be heartless and tell your client that you won't do it, just tell him that you would love to provide financial assistance, but this rule prevents you from doing so. And again, that's a conflict of interest because then you're kind of getting a proprietary interest in the case, and that could affect your judgment because you at that point are not necessarily just acting in your client's interest, but you might be tempted to act in your own interest. Now, a situation that probably does come up more frequently is the fee is paid by somebody other than the client. So you get a phone call at midnight from somebody's mom and dad saying, Junior just got arrested for DWI. Can you represent him? And we will pay you. Well, that probably comes up pretty frequently, and it is permissible, but there's a potential for a conflict of interest there. There's a potential for you to lose your independence because normally if you would go into a store and you're paying money, you say, I'm paying the bill, the customer is always right. Well, in the practice of law, that's not necessarily true. The person paying the bill is not necessarily always right. The client is always right because, as we learned from, I think, Rule 1.1 or 1.2, the client, the person you are representing, has to be 100% in the driver's seat. But it is permissible, and like I say, it probably comes up pretty often. First of all, the client must consent to this. And Wisconsin has two little twists on that. There's an exception if the lawyer is appointed at government expense. So if you're a public defender or accepting an appointment, that exception might apply, and the rule is slightly different, so take a look at that. A situation that comes up rather frequently is that the insurance company is the one paying you. So you're representing the defendant in a traffic accident, and the insurance company is the one paying you. And here, basically, the Wisconsin kind of clarified that that the client obviously has to be aware that the insurance company is paying it, but that requirement that the client consent, that's met by the fact that on page 42 in the insurance policy, it said that would happen. So you do not need to obtain an additional consent after beginning the representation. The fact that that consent was given in the insurance policy is adequate. Number two is the big one. It cannot interfere with the lawyer's independence. So again, normally in any kind of business transaction, you know, the customer is always right, and the customer is the one, you know, paying the money. Well, in the practice of law, the customer paying the money is not the one in charge. The one in charge, the customer who is always right, is the client that you're representing, who is not necessarily the person who is paying the bill. And finally, confidential information must be maintained. Even though these people are paying the money, they are not privy to any information in the case. They stand in the same position as anybody. The only information you provide them is tell them to send another check. So somebody other than the client paying the fee, it can happen, but all those conditions have to be met. If you are representing more than one party, it's always there's always the potential for conflict of interest there, whether in a civil case or a criminal case. So you always have to watch out for the possibility that people's interests might start getting adverse, even if they're not at the beginning. And one specific rule is that any aggregate settlement must be approved by everybody. So if you are representing a husband and a wife who are injured in a car accident, they are offered one sum to settle both of their claims. So the insurance company says we'll write you a check for $100,000 payable to husband and wife, and you figure out how it's going to be divided. Well, that has to be approved by all of the clients. You cannot ask a client to prospectively waive malpractice claims. So when you write your retainer agreement, for future use, make sure it doesn't say anything like that. And keep in mind, this rule is not just saying that that if you ask a client to waive a malpractice claim that that's unenforceable, which it probably is, but if you have a retainer agreement, where you have the client sign and say, I promise never to sue attorney for malpractice, not only is that not enforceable, but that also subjects you to discipline just for asking for it, even if you don't commit malpractice. So be sure to avoid that. Now, there's one very small exception, unless the client is independently represented when making that waiver. So I suppose that could come up occasionally when one attorney, subcontracts or out part of the case. I'm going to have some different attorney write this brief in here, and he's concerned about getting sued for malpractice. So if the client is independently represented, that could happen. And also, you can't prospectively waive malpractice claims. Of course, you can retrospectively waive malpractice claims. So if your client says you committed malpractice and you want to settle it, they can settle the case. So say here's $10,000 to settle your malpractice claim, and you promise not to sue me for that malpractice claim. That is proper, but you can't do it prospectively. You can't do it for malpractice that might happen in the future. And whether or not it's in the future or in the past, you cannot ask a client not to report you to the disciplinary authorities. Just asking them to do that is what will get you into trouble. So you say, please don't call up the state bar or the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility or whatever it's called in your state to report. You know, please do not report me for any misconduct that I might have committed. And again, just asking them to do that constitutes a violation, whether or not you did anything wrong in the first place. So don't tell people, please don't turn me in. As we mentioned before, you cannot have basically a lien against your client's property except in certain situations. This part of the rule is more specific, that you cannot acquire a proprietary interest in the cause of action. You can't own part of your client's lawsuit. Now, the first exception is kind of a big exception, the second one, actually. The first one is an attorney's lien, if authorized by law. Some states have a statute for, in certain situations, kind of like a mechanic's lien, that you, the mechanic, might be able to enforce a lien against the proceeds of some lawsuit that you brought. So if it's a lien like that that arises under the state statutes, that's okay, even though that is a proprietary interest in the cause of action. The second exception, though, is pretty big. You can have a reasonable contingent fee in a civil case. Now, when we talk about fees, there are very specific requirements on what is allowed in a contingency fee case. So you have to comply with that. If you don't comply with that rule about fees, then you're also violating this rule because you acquired a proprietary interest in the cause of action. So that's an exception. The contingency fee is an exception to that rule, but obviously it's a pretty big exception because that's exactly what it is. You have a one-third interest in your client's cause of action. The following rule has been around. They were debating it, I think, about 20 years ago when I was in law school, that a lawyer may not have sexual relations with his client unless that relationship predated the legal representation. And if it's an institutional client, you know, you're a counsel for a corporation or something, then that applies to the person or persons who supervise you. Now, all of these rules in Rule 1.8, with the exception of that last one, apply to all lawyers in the same firm. So another lawyer in your firm drafting a will or paying the fee, all of those prohibitions apply to all the lawyers in your firm, not just the individual lawyer. So those are the rules regarding conflicts of interest with present clients. Rule 1.9 talks about conflicts of interest relating to your former clients. Depending on who your former clients are, that affects who you can take on as your future clients and what you can do for those future clients. The rule starts by stating the general rule. If you have represented a former client, then you cannot represent another person in the same or substantially related matter without the consent of the former client. So if you were involved in a particular matter or a substantially related matter, then you cannot represent other people in connection with that same matter without the consent of the former client. Wisconsin says that consent must be signed by the former client. It has to be in writing in all three states, so I would think generally something in writing, you probably want to get their signature on it, but Wisconsin adds that in specifically. If the firm in which a lawyer Okay, I'm sorry. The next rule talks about if another lawyer in your firm representing a person. So in other words, former clients of other attorneys in your firm, the former clients of other lawyers in your firm when they were in your firm. Later on, we talk about former clients of other attorneys in your firm. In other words, people who were their clients before they joined your firm. But this rule talks about other lawyers in the firm representing somebody. In that case, if somebody else in your firm had represented a person, then you may not represent anybody materially adverse to that person if that lawyer acquired confidential information during the course of the representation. So in other words, your partner represented somebody and during the course of that learned confidential information. And as we talked about before, pretty much everything learned during the representation is probably confidential. So you cannot represent people materially adverse to that person. If you gained information during the course of a prior representation, then you cannot use that to your former client's disadvantage unless there's a specific exception elsewhere in the rules. Now, this, again, is not just this is much broader than the attorney-client evidentiary privilege. If you learned information during the course of the representation, even if that was not confidential in any way, you just, became an expert on some factual part of the case because you were representing that client, then you cannot use that information to your former client's disadvantage unless it is specifically permitted by the rules or if the information has become generally known. So, for example, you are maybe you're starting out in the practice of law, and I know in a lot of big cities there are these document review kinds of things that are going on all the time. So maybe you are doing some document review work in a some kind of environmental case or something, and you're reviewing these thousands of pages of documents, and you might kind of become an expert on some scientific area or something. Well, even though that information is not necessarily confidential in and of itself, the fact that you became an expert in that scientific field as a result of that, that might prevent you from using that, or that would prevent you from using that information to that client's disadvantage later on. Unless the information has become generally known. So again, it's kind of a gray area there because that information might have become generally known. But there probably, you would probably best avoid directly going against that client because that would be a pretty clear conflict of interest. And finally, you may not reveal information relating to the representation of a former client. And there the rules are the same as what you're allowed to reveal for your current clients. So as far as information gained during the course of a representation, the rules are identical, whether or not they're a former client or a present client. So those are your duties to your former clients. Rule 1.8, in general, those previous rules that we talked about, conflicts of interest and disqualifications, in general, we were referring to your former clients. And Rule 1.10 talks about if one lawyer in a firm is disqualified because of the conflict of interest rules, whether other lawyers in that firm are also disqualified. And in general, yes. So if because of some kind of conflict of interest, you are not able to take a case, then as a general rule, partners and associates in your same firm are not allowed to take the case either. You all stand in the same position. Now, there are a couple of exceptions to that, but they are fairly narrow, and it has to fit all the requirements of the exception. The first exception is if you are not allowed to take the case because of an interest that is personal to you. So, for example, it's not just a conflict of interest because of two clients, two possibly conflicting clients. But, for example, you can't take the case because you had engaged in some kind of business transaction with this client. Maybe you gave him a second mortgage on his house or something. So you can't take the case because you have a proprietary interest in his property. In that case, though, that would come under this exception. So therefore, the other lawyers in your firm could still take that case if there is no significant risk that their representation would be materially limited. So it would be a situation to watch out for, but it would not be an absolute prohibition if the disqualification arises from something personal to you. Now, the other exception that maybe other lawyers in your office can take the case is that basically former clients of there might be an exception in cases of your former clients. So if the conflict of interest arises from Rule 1.9 because it's a conflict because of one of your former clients, then maybe the other lawyers in your office can take the case if all three of these conditions are met. First of all, you did only minor and isolated services, and it was not when you were with this firm, it was when you were with another firm. In some of the metropolitan areas where young lawyers are working on these document review things, you were doing a document review case and you are representing the Acme Insurance Company. And then later you are hired by a law firm and one of their clients is suing the Acme Insurance Company. Well, if you were not with this firm when you were doing that, and you were doing only minor and isolated services. So, I was just looking at these documents, and that was when I was with a different firm. So it might be okay. So that condition might be met. But even if that condition is met, you need to be screened from any participation in the new matter, and you can't receive any fee from it. So even if you are a partner in the firm, and you normally receive one half of all the fees that come into the firm, this would have to be an exception to the partnership agreement, and you would not be entitled to get any fee. And you would need to be screened off. They can't talk to you about the case. You can't talk to them about the case. There has to be some screen in place to make sure that none of that information that you have, no matter how minor, gets to the new client. And written notice must be given to the former client. So you'd have to... your firm would have to send a letter to the Acme Insurance Company saying that this lawyer in our office used to represent you in these minor services, and we are continuing on with this case. They don't have to consent to it, but they have to be given notice, which of course would probably give them the right to object. So there are some situations where that might come up, but you have to be careful with it. So the fact that you were an attorney for the Acme Insurance Company and then in your future employment, potentially causes problems for representing people suing that former client. Now, the next part of the rule talks about former lawyers' former clients. In other words, it's talking about... If you join the firm, or an attorney joins the firm, he had former clients before he joined the firm, and now he left the firm. So in 1990, an attorney represented somebody. In 2000, he joined your firm, and in 2010, he quit your firm. In general, that's not a problem. An attorney who left your firm, the clients he or she had before joining your firm, that does not disqualify you. However, there still might be some problems. So here the general rule is that it's okay, but there might be some situations where it's not okay. First of all, it would not be okay if the matter is the same or substantially related to the matter in which they represented the clients. So if it's kind of the same case, you have to watch out. I should at this point, and I always forget these, for our podcast listeners, our first code word is conflict. Our first code word is conflict. We're talking about conflicts of interest, and our first podcast code word is conflict. So again, this conflict might be still be improper if it's substantially, if the same or substantially similar case. If the lawyers in the firm had confidential information about this former lawyer's former clients, then it would not be okay. This kind of conflict can be waived, as any conflict or as most conflicts can be waived, other than the real blatant ones. And finally, there's also an exception for former government attorneys. And there are a special set of rules for that, Rule 1.11. In fact, we will turn directly to those, Rule 1.11. And this talks about lawyers who work for the government. And in general, the rules for former government attorneys are somewhat less stringent, and they are covered in Rule 1.11. The rules for former private sector attorneys. So if you represented somebody in the private sector and then you go to work for the government, generally the same conflict of interest rules apply, and as well they should, because if you have a former client that you still owe duties to, it doesn't help that former client at all if you now work for the government and you're using the information against him in your governmental capacity. So these rules talk mostly about former government attorneys who leave the public sector and go to the private sector. And the reason why the rules are a little bit different is because there's kind of a certain amount of necessity that if you work for the prosecutor's office once you start working for them, can you never practice criminal law again? Because you'll probably go up against your old colleagues occasionally, and they're your former client, the state. That shouldn't necessarily bar you from life or from representing people against the state. So the rules are a little bit different when it comes to government attorneys moving to the private sector, and that if your former client was the government or even a court or administrative agency, the rules in Rule 1.11 apply. First of all, Rule 1.9, information that you gained in a previous case, that does apply, even in the case of a former government attorney. So if you learned information during the course of a case, you were working in the prosecutor's office when they prosecuted somebody for DWI, and you know what his blood alcohol level was, that previous information that you learned from that case, that Rule 1.9 still applies, and you can't use that confidential information later on. Also, you cannot represent a client in a case where you participated personally unless the government agency in question gives consent to that. In other words, you were prosecuting John Smith, and you were personally involved in that case. You can't quit the prosecutor's office and go to work for John Smith and defend him in the same case. But although even in that case, that is one. This is kind of an exception in the where the government would be able to consent to that. And it's not just necessarily adversarial kinds of things. So, for example, if you worked for the Federal Communications Commission and you were not, it was not an adversary thing, but you were participated personally in some case that was before that agency, this bars you from representing clients in connection with that same matter. In general, other lawyers in your firm are also disqualified. So the government, the former government lawyer joins a law firm. The other lawyers in that firm are probably also disqualified, and the general rule is that they are disqualified unless it comes under this exception, and both portions of this have to be met. Three tests, actually. First of all, the lawyer who used to work for the government agency has to be screened off, and again, screened means he or she cannot give or receive information about that case. He can't know anything about that case. He can't get any part of the fee. Again, even if that person is a partner in the firm and he normally gets half the firm's fees, he can't get half the fee in that case. And notice has to be given to the government agency. So they have to be aware that that this former attorney is there, but that other lawyers in the firm will be handling it. If you, during your government employment, learned confidential information about anyone, then you may not represent anybody adverse to that person if that person possibly could be used to their disadvantage. So, for example, you work for the Securities and Exchange Commission, and as a part of your employment, it's not an adversarial thing, but you are reviewing, corporate profits or whatever, and you have this confidential information that the company only gave to the government because they had to, and on the condition that it was going to be confidential. You can't use that later on. You know that this company earned $1 million from doing something. Well, you can't use that information to their disadvantage. Other lawyers in your firm might still continue on in that case, but you have to be screened off completely, and you can't share on the fee. The next paragraph here talks about what I said before. Current government lawyers are still bound by all the conflict of interest rules. And again, if your private lawyer, you give them confidential information and you know that it's going to be confidential, well, it's still confidential even if he goes to work for the government. So that just reiterates that the general conflict of interest rules still apply whether you go to work for a private person or for the government. Current government lawyers may not negotiate for employment in a case in which they're participating. So you work for the prosecutor's office. You're involved in the Jones case. You can't talk to the lawyers for the Jones case and negotiate going to work for them. This is also true if you work more critical if you're in some kind of adjudicatory official. The judge can't ask people, hey, can I come to work for you? Resign from the bench, or an administrative agency. Now there is an exception there for judicial law clerks. Because it's kind of understood that they're only going to be there for a year or two, and they might ask for a job with one of the firms in a case before their judge. But there are some very strict conditions in the rule that have to be looked at on that one. One other little Wisconsin twist. And this kind of makes sense. I don't think they really had to include this, but Wisconsin says that for the purposes of the imputed conflicts of interest rule, the government agency is not a law firm. So what that's saying is, if I go to work for Smith and Jones, well, Smith and Jones might be barred from participating in certain cases because of that. If I go to work for the county attorney's office, that doesn't mean that they can never prosecute my former clients again. So Wisconsin just kind of clarifies that, but I think that's pretty clear. Moving on to Rule 1.12, talks about former judges and the like. Now, we probably don't have too many former judges on the line today, but this rule also applies to anybody in kind of an adjudicatory position, such as a former judge or an arbitrator or a mediator or any kind of neutral third party. So you as an arbitrator or mediator are essentially bound by the same rules as for judges. And you cannot represent anybody in the case in which you served as an arbitrator or judge or any kind of a neutral. And you can't negotiate for employment, again, with an exception for judicial law clerks. And in some cases, the lawyer may participate in the matter if the conflict is waived. However, Wisconsin does not even allow you to waive that. So in Minnesota or Iowa or most of the other states, it would be okay for if the plaintiff and defendant are before the judge and the judge says, you know what, I'm going to resign from the bench and go represent the plaintiff. In many states, the defendant could say, well, that's just fine. We waive any conflict. However, in Wisconsin, that cannot be waived, although it probably doesn't come up too often. And if you are disqualified, then your firm is also disqualified unless you are screened and you do not share any part of the fee. So a former judge steps down from the bench, joins a private law firm. They could still take still represent people in cases that were before that former judge, but he or she would have to be screened off completely and not share in the fee. There's kind of an exception to that. Like I say, that rule applies not just to judges, but any kind of arbitrator. There is an exception in the case of a multi-member arbitration panel. So there's a three-member arbitration panel where each party selects one arbitrator, and those two arbitrators select the third arbitrator. The partisan arbitrator that is selected by the party can represent that party. So that's kind of an exception. The partisan arbitrator is an exception to this. And in Wisconsin, everybody has to consent to that. The other states don't say anything specifically about consent. Let's see, Rule 1.13. The previous rules have all talked about an individual being a client. So you represent one person. Rule 1.13 talks about the situation where the client is not a natural person, but the client is some kind of organization. And this kind of makes clear, and again, this comes from the law of agency, but makes clear that the lawyer representing the organization represents the organization. He or she does not represent individuals within that organization. Although, as we will see later, it might be possible for him to represent individuals. Therefore, even if you are the general counsel for a firm, so you represent the firm. You don't represent any individuals. So if you, for example, become aware that the president of the corporation is doing something that is illegal or doing something that that harms the organization, that violates a legal duty that that person has, even though that might be the person who supervises you, you have an obligation not to that person, but you have an obligation to the corporation. So you always must act in the best interest of the corporation and not necessarily to individuals, even if they happen to be your boss or something. And in general, what that duty means is that if you become aware of any kind of misconduct like that, you have to report it to somebody with higher up in the organization who has the ability to correct it. That might even allow you to disclose it to third parties. So if you as a lawyer become aware that your client is dumping toxic waste, you know, if this continues, they might face millions of dollars in fines. But if it's nipped in the bud, you know, you can maybe the harm will not be so great. Well, in that situation, you might even be able to violate your confidences to report it, to turn it in. Now, that would not apply if you were retained for the purposes of investigating that possible violation. So they. You know, they say we're hiring this attorney to represent us in this toxic dumping case. Well, you can't just fulfill that obligation simply by turning in the behavior they asked you to represent them for. This obligation continue even if even after you've been fired. So if you get fired for being a whistleblower, so for example, under that previous paragraph. You thought that you had to turn in the toxic waste people, and you became a whistleblower. Well, if you're fired for being a whistleblower, you still have the obligation to report that that whistleblowing information. So, if you're fired for telling the board of directors that there's toxic waste dumping going on. Even though you're fired, you still have an obligation to follow through and tell the board of directors about this toxic waste and why they should stop doing it, why it's in the company's best interest to stop doing it. If an employee that you're talking to in the corporation is confused about you know, if they think that you are representing them and not the organization, then you have an affirmative duty. To let them know if their interests are actually adverse. So I guess you have to tell your boss that I'm going to turn you in for dumping the toxic waste because I'm not representing you, I'm representing the corporation. And in general, you can, though, represent employees and officers. So if you represent the trucking company you can represent the trucking company and the driver who was involved in the accident. But again, you are representing two people. You're representing the company and the individual. So you have to keep in mind that that's two different clients, so that there might need to be some consent. I think we'll wrap up with Rule 1.14 today, and then Rule 1.15 is kind of a long one, so that's where we will start next week. Rule 1.14 talks about clients with diminished capacity, and our code word for the podcast listeners, our next code word, our second and last code word, will be capacity. Our second code word is capacity. And this rule talks about dealing with clients with diminished capacity. So, for example, you're representing an infant or you are representing somebody because of some disability is no longer able to make all of their decisions themselves. The rule starts by saying that in such a situation, to the extent possible, you should still continue to maintain a normal lawyer-client relationship with the person. But this rule builds in exceptions to some other rules that can happen in that situation. First of all, the rules about confidentiality. There's an exception to that. Normally, everything your client tells you is confidential, and they are in the driver's seat, and they decide whether or not you disclose it. But if you believe that your client has a diminished capacity because one of these disabilities it talks about up here, and if you think they are at risk of substantial physical, financial, or other harm, then this rule does not obligate you to do it, although other rules might obligate you to, but this says that there's an exception to confidentiality. You may take whatever steps you believe are necessary to take protective action, and that can include talking to other people and breaching confidentiality. And you may also seek to do things like have a conservator appointed. So, for example, your elderly client comes in and they tell you how they're sending money to this email person in Nigeria because they got these emails and they won't listen to reason. Well, in that situation, you might need to breach the confidentiality if you think that that was caused by a disability on their part. Then you may breach that confidentiality to bring it to the attention of somebody in a position to do something about it. And again, you're not required to take that action under this rule, but you're authorized to do so. But you still need to take care. So, and as the ABA comment here notes, if you know that this person has had an acrimonious relationship with their children all their life, well, then you probably shouldn't reveal it to that child. But the rule does open up the possibility of revealing information that would otherwise be confidential. Well, I see we have just about we're at about an hour here. I will stop the recording here in a moment. Any podcast listeners, if you do have any substantive questions, please email them to me at clem.law@usa.net, and I will answer them in the time allowed by the rule. Thank you for joining me.